This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Last May, the Kansas State Board of Education held hearings on proposed changes to its curriculum standards, namely that evolution should be taught as a controversial scientific idea, not as a universally accepted one. Over 3 days, more than 20 witnesses, all supportive of the curriculum change, offered testimony that natural selection had both critics and competing theories, including intelligent design, and argued that students should learn about them all in biology class. Pro-Darwinian forces sent no witnesses, but rather an attorney who called for the dissolution of the hearings and played the role of cross-examiner. In the language of the proceedings, he was the representative of, quote, mainstream science, which effectively staged a boycott. If mainstream science can opt out of the debate, the mainstream media doesn't have that luxury.
Should intelligent design be taught alongside the theory of evolution? We'll have a special report and a debate.
And when the president weighs in, as he did on August 1st, saying that both sides ought to be properly taught, even a pseudo-debate rises unambiguously to the status of news. The question for journalists is not whether to cover it, but how. Just last month, NPR's science correspondent, David Kestenbaum, wrestled with the story, and he joins me now. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So, months ago on this show, we had on the editor of Scientific American, John Rennie, and he said that journalists make a fetish out of balance. In other words, if a source says X, reporters will inevitably get somebody else to say Y. And Rennie believes that this is very often inappropriate when applied to stories about science.
Well, I think we agree with that. I mean, if you take something like climate change, I think in stories what you'll hear is that the vast majority of scientists believe that humans are changing the climate and causing the planet to get warmer. And then the story might say something like, there are some people who do disagree with that, and here's one of them. But you would try and set the scale of both sides. One of the things I really like about covering science is that, you know, there is an answer. It's not like politics where anybody's opinion may have some merit. Any question that can be posed scientifically is something that can be tested and can be proven right or wrong.
I feel humbled arguing this with you, David, but the fact is there are things that are theories before they become fact.
For sure. And, you know, it's your job as a journalist to say where each theory is. But, you know, evolution is as much of a fact as you get in the scientific world. That's an assumption in a lot of stories we do. Any story which discusses whether the avian flu virus could evolve, jump into humans and maybe kill a lot of people, you don't say, you know, if evolution is right. When you do a story about genetics and mentioning that humans and chimps share some 99% of their DNA, the line that'll come after that is because they branched off from the evolutionary tree relatively recently.
But you reported a story recently on NPR about the debate between evolutionary biologists and advocates of intelligent design, many of whom believe that life is so improbably complex that there simply must be a creator. So was this a story that was full of minefields for you?
It was, and we thought a lot about how to approach it. And the solution I had was that we should push the problem off onto the scientists and talk about why it was the scientists didn't like to debate in an open forum, originally the creationists, and now don't like to debate the intelligent design people. And it became a discussion about how the mainstream scientific community had chosen to deal with something which they view as completely non-scientific.
I'm reminded of a piece in The New Yorker a few months back by a science professor named H. Allen Orr. What he did was he took each of the various subgroups of the intelligent design theory and then explained why they simply couldn't hold water. This is precisely the sort of thing that I think a lot of scientists and perhaps a lot of science reporters wish that people wouldn't do, because by talking about these theories, you present them as if they offer a viable alternative to evolution, and they don't.
We got emails to that effect afterwards. I got some emails from, I suppose, who you might call creationist types, who said, thank you for pointing out that the scientists don't like to debate us because clearly they're wrong. And we got emails from people saying, why didn't you stand up and defend evolution? We didn't want to get into that because, you know, we thought that raised it unfairly as something that deserved sort of scientific debate.
But obviously, plenty of people out there need to have it explained all over again, or else they will lend it the same sort of false equality that one might say The president did when he remarked that both sides ought to be properly taught. So don't you, as a reporter, have an obligation to explain evolution again?
I'll tell you, there's a little piece of paper by my desk, and it has stories to do. And one is a 3.5-minute defense of evolution. I mean, one of the things that came up when I was doing that story is the scientist said, well, look, it's just so hard to explain in, they said, an hour of a debate. And I thought, are you kidding me, an hour? And I thought, all right, well, this is my job then to try and find the greatest examples and jam them into 3.5 minutes. So we'll see how it goes.
Well, let's talk about this piece that you just did with two primary sources, one a biology professor from Brown University who's squarely in the pro-Darwin camp, and the other a biochemist at Lehigh University who's a big proponent of intelligent design. So how did you structure the story so as not to lend a kind of he said, she said equality that Jonathan Rennie at the Scientific American says is inappropriate?
Well, I think there's actually a nice little moment in that story. I'm talking to the intelligent design advocate, and I say, so what's it like being an intelligent design guy at an academic university? And he goes, it's pretty lonely. And, you know, he laid it out there. You didn't need me to say, I've counted and there are 10 million scientists on this side and 5 on the other. And I thought the real question behind the story, when you look at, as you mentioned, the case in Kansas, how the scientific community decided to deal with it or not deal with it. And in some ways, I think that's more interesting than the back and forth who's right.
The New York Times has recently run a multi-part series under the heading A Debate Over Darwin. Do you think reporters run the risk of legitimizing what most consider to be pseudoscience by giving it too much attention?
Yeah, I do think that's a danger, and that's why we decided to handle the story the way we did. It's interesting. I've been reading some blogs by scientists who are unhappy with parts of the New York Times story, and then Kenneth Chang, who wrote one of them for the New York Times, has then been entering into a debate on the blogs with the scientists saying, but look what I said in these 1,000 words of my story here. It's true the first paragraph says what you say, but look at the rest of my story. And that's the hard part for journalists is that people hear what they want to hear a lot of time, or people hear what they don't want to hear.
These poor science reporters, they ought to try covering the Middle East for a while. David, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Brooke.
David Kestenbaum is a science reporter for National Public Radio.